Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast. I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wool.
And you've been invited in.
I want to do bad things with you.
Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series, episode by episode.
This week, we wrap up season two, Deb, with episode 212. It's named for the haunting Bob Dylan song, Beyond Here Lies Nothing. It was written by Alexander Wu and directed by Michael Cuesta.
Well, we reach our climax of the season with a wedding for a maenad. So we'll dive into the mythology behind the story and how the show pays homage to that history. And then we will have the dazzling Michelle Forbes join us to talk all things Marianne.
While she plays an excellent villain on True Blood, you'll also know her from just a few of her 73 career credits, like The Killing, Big Sky, New Amsterdam, The Returned, Chicago Fire, In Treatment, Battlestar Galactica, 24, Star Trek, and The Guiding Light. Oh, I'm practically out of breath.
Still breathing?
All that and still two Emmy nominations to mention. Ugh,
I mean, she signs every time she graces the screen, and it is no exception this week on True Blood.
The big day has arrived. The whole town has turned out, and Marianne is all a flutter. Sookie is the last to remain unaffected by her powers, but is nevertheless held captive by the maenad, who busily prepares for her wedding to the god, who she knows this time will come.
God with horns! Worship him, bitches!
As Lafayette places the finishing touches on Dimitri, Bill arrives with Sam as an offering to Marianne in exchange for Sookie. Despite Sookie's objections, the trade is made.
A frenzy-eyed Egg steps forward and stabs Sam as sacrifice. Sookie lashes out, interrupting the ceremony and causing Marianne to give chase. But a white bull emerges from the dark, stopping Marianne in her tracks. Submitting to what she believes is the will of Dionysus, it gores her through the heart, only to transform into a now healed Sam Merlot.
Was there no god?
Understanding now that this was Bill and Sam's plan all along, Sookie gets to work setting things right at Grand's, while Sam goes looking for his biological parents and perhaps some answers.
Having awoken from their trance, the people of Bon Tom go back to life as usual, and everything seems hunky-dory. But all is not well with Eggs.
It's all over now. Sookie, why do I have this sick feeling that it's not?
He convinces Sookie to help him get his memory back, but seeing the lives taken by his hand, he is unable to go on. Bearing the knife as evidence of his wrongdoing, he threatens Andy unless he agrees to lock him away. Jason sees the altercation from afar and fires, killing Eggs. Andy takes the blame as Tara falls to her knees, grieving the loss of her one true love.
Across town, Sookie and Bill are enjoying a beautiful evening of dancing and dessert. But Bill has a few more tricks up his sleeve. He reveals a ring and a ticket to Vermont. Sookie is flustered and leaves the table to gather her thoughts, but the more she considers it, the more confident she becomes of her answer.
Yes! Yes, Bill Compton, I will marry you!
She races back to the table to find it in disarray, and Bill is nowhere to be found.
So, Deb, what was your highlight for this episode?
So, for me, I mean, we're not going to talk a ton about it because Michelle Forbes really covers this moment, I think, in her interview. But that bull,
oh my goodness.
That shot of it stepping out of the darkness, Oh, it sells the story so strongly. Then there's that incredible 50-50 of Michelle Forbes standing just, I mean, inches from this majestic animal. And,
massive, you know, animal.
And she's just alone in this vast nothingness. I don't know how they got it that dark. I mean, even that just really just shocks me. And, you know, I mean, there's something to working with live animals, right? They're not acting. They're just present. And it has to bring you present. So, you know, again, she's told the story of how they, you know, unfortunately brought out the puppet bull head at the same time as the first bull was there and totally spooked it, which meant they had to get the less tame bull to come and work with her, which I'm sure, you know, was a little antsy there. But, you know, what I do think is interesting is actually how great the special effects are in that moment.
So
that
good.
The fusing of the puppet head that they, you know, attached to Mishka with the actual bull's body for that moment. I mean, it's pretty flawless.
It's really flawless, isn't
it? I really don't see the seams on that. So I'm, again, it's that the ideal meshing of practical effect and CGI as support that I think, you know, really wins every time.
Yeah. And then the actor, you know, she sells it so much with her different turns, you know, where she's, I mean, the sort of silliness of how do you marry a bull goes away immediately because she's so moved.
You're 100% correct. The whole time I'm mesmerized by her and it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll remind everyone at home. So that entire wedding sequence was 5 or 6 days straight of all nights. So getting there before the sun goes down, working right up until the sun comes up. And, you know, with those, a lot of people wearing those terrible contacts, you know, Mishka in that dress that she kept tripping on. And
my
claws.
Last night up there at Greer was 19 degrees.
It's very, very cold.
Always below freezing out there.
Yeah. You've got all these people, you've got animals, you've got, I mean, it is, it is a circus.
It is a circus with rotting meat, you know, at the center.
It's coyotes just howling in the distance.
Yeah, you know? Just dying to get at it. Oh. It is a total crazy circus.
Yeah. And you have a lot of things that are like, you have one shot at this, right? So pushing that meat tree over, they have one take of that.
Right.
You know,
they have
stepping
one
up to that bull. You only get what you get, right? If that bull decides it's done acting for the night, you're done.
Mm-hmm. You're done.
So just the amount of pressure and the amount of cool that everybody has to keep while still performing her fucking heart out.
Well,
what an amazing person.
While imagining that this is Dionysus.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like she's got this massive thing on her shoulders that is very complex, which you researched and we're going to get into.
Yeah. But then for your highlight, Kristen, and I also agree with this 100%, this would have also been my highlight, is the proposal at the end, the incredible Bill and Sookie denouement to this story.
Everything about that has the same level of care and preparation.
Yes.
You know, the dress, Anna mentioned in the commentary, was built, designed by Audrey Fisher, and then built by Olga for Anna. You know, inspiration were pictures from classic stars like Elizabeth Taylor. Right. So beautiful. Grace Kelly wore a dress like that in Rear Window, I believe. So beautiful, beautiful old movie feel, the hair, the lighting.
The jewelry. I mean, she's just a vision in that scene.
She's a vision.
You know, and again, it's that lit from within thing. You know, they've lit her beautifully, but it's a light within Anna, you know?
It is. And and with Steven, with Bill and Sookie, you know, it's just, and they're dancing. I was wondering, right? Did they just show up? They probably did just show up. And I would be bumping into the person and, oh, do you spin me left or right? You know, but they just look like they're having effortless fun.
Yeah.
Right. And then we get to the proposal where she has to do this unbelievable Olympic acting feat of, I've always wanted this. She loves this man. He almost died. He's alive. He's proposing. And yet, wait a minute.
the heaviness of the season hits her, and I don't know what I am, and wait, I'm going to die and you're not.
Ugh. And what happens when I grow old and weak and you're still the same? What then?
I don't care about any of that. I want you just as you are.
But I'm not even sure what I am.
Yeah.
And those alligator tears.
Ugh.
And then she has to run to the bathroom, which is shot in another day.
Yeah.
Right?
To me, the bathroom, you know, looking in the mirror, that scene is... Yeah. Is really kind of a masterclass, I think.
Yeah.
No dialogue.
Right.
Just thoughts, you know, and some props and yourself to look at. And, yeah. You know, it'd be easy to either ham that up, I think, and try to really like
do more.
Sort of project, you know, more. But she is so subtle. And yet I can read every thought she's having.
Yes.
And she goes, you know, she has to walk in with tears streaming down her face and leave glowing. Which is just spectacular.
And, you know, there's, you know, that phrase I always say here on the podcast, which is, do they watch the show? You know, and I could say that a lot in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, Andy and Jason are like, let's just go in there and save the town. And I'm like, they don't watch the show.
30 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah, that's 30 less than that. Yeah. But, you know, the people, apparently, Anna thought she remembered that they'd rented a restaurant.
Yes.
But the people on the restaurant watched the show.
Yes.
And we're like, no. So then they had to get a house and transform that into a restaurant. And then they had to film it on two different days. So she doesn't get to run off. This from the scene into the bathroom and back in. It's two different days.
Yeah. And but I think actually in a way it's one of those like blessings in disguise. I kind of love that it looks so special. It doesn't look like a restaurant.
Right.
It does kind of look like someone's home in Louisiana who was an amazing chef and turned the bottom floor of their home into a little restaurant. There's something really special about it.
There is.
That works for me, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Those are special restaurants, actually. There's one in Hollywood. I've been to one in Germany. They're pretty neat. That's true.
Yeah. And I like the idea, too. You know, at this point, it's well known that Stephen and Anna are a couple. Mm-hmm. They also, you know, we're 24 episodes in. They know these characters inside and out. And I think as a writer and a director, Alex and Michael were smart to just, like, get out of their way. Just step back. They are locked into this. And I mean, they talk about it. They said, you know, we did a couple of takes, but just because we could and because we wanted to see it. Like they just as a viewer wanted to watch Stephen and Anna do this incredible work. And I agree. You know, I think Michael said it as well. Michael Cuesta, the director, said it. There's a moment when Bill realizes she might be turning him down.
I love that moment.
And he sort of leans back and says, is that no? And you just, it's like, oh, my heart broke for him.
I know. You're like, Daddy.
I know.
I know. It is interesting because we're talking about watching actors that we're friends with and we know these people and we worked with these people. And then Michelle Forbes and Anna in the commentary mentioned many times what it's like to be in a scene with Lafayette, Jason, or, you know, or each other, and that they were either laughing or mesmerized or missed their take. And it is something for us when we're in a scene with people. I was often famous for it would be quiet for a long time. And then I would sort of snap out of it and be like, why is everyone looking at me? Oh, shit. Sorry. Can we go back? Because I was really watching these incredible performances right in front of me.
Well, that's always why at the end of the day, I didn't watch the show. And it does mean that I missed some things and I'm making up for that now. But there were moments where I was like, I've seen Anna front row, right? Yeah. Like I've seen her work literally inches in front of me. I've seen what she's capable. I've seen Stephen and I you know, I've watched those moments in a more intimate way than anyone has at home. Like, screw all you folks, right? Like, I had the money seat.
Totally.
So in a way, I was like, I don't want to trade the first person POV of that moment that I have for the camera lens one. You know, that was so special to witness it in the moment.
I think it's rare for me that I could watch it on television and that it could hold up to what I experienced on the day.
Yeah, because it won't, you know, it's always a little less than, if only because energetically you're not there. And if only because I didn't see the take before where you did something completely different. And so this blew my mind that you had a whole new take on it. You know, it's the nature of the beast is that it is always a little less than. That doesn't mean worse, just a little less than the experience. And
for us.
And that can be a little bit of a letdown for those of us who were there.
It is. It is.
Yeah. So then I think the show highlight, you know, it was hard to pick. I mean, again, the wedding, the proposal, all of this is a highlight.
Right.
But we're setting up a season three.
Yeah.
You know, this is similar to the finale of the first season, which is that like the main storyline kind of wraps up about halfway through. And we spend the rest of this episode kind of teasing out the mysteries coming up.
Yeah, they do a great job of that.
When I particularly like Bill Sanderson, you know, as Bud, has this great line that I think kind of sums up the season for us.
This town's a hell of a mess, and I'm man enough to know I can't shoulder it myself. You might have your faults, Sandy, but at least you got pants on.
Bet in Von Thomas how you hire back the sheriff, right?
Your detective has pants on, so
you get the job. Yeah.
So yes, so you know the one thing that we didn't mention from Bill and Sookie there at the end,
is
gone. We're setting up who took Bill and what is Sookie going to do about it.
Yep, we've got some suspects here because. Eric said, I'll take care of Bill Compton. Mm-hmm. The queen was pretty unhappy about it. Mm-hmm. We always have Lorena.
She is always a wild card. Yes.
Yep.
And there's a lot about Bill's past we don't know. So it really kind of could be anyone. And then we have Sam. So Sam, you know, he spent the season, I think, kind of accepting who he is and you know, I think becoming more curious about why he is the way he is. So he's looking for his biological family.
Yeah.
Who have been described to us as bad people.
Yeah.
By some other kind of bad people. So I don't know how reliable that narrator is.
Or does that mean they're really bad?
Maybe.
You know? And poor Sam, in the commentary, Anna and Michelle said, who's had it worse, Tara or Sam? You know, the loss is so extraordinary. And he has such a beautiful moment with tears.
Yeah. Oh,
there were some men crying in this episode that really got me.
There were some really strong, male vulnerability.
Yeah, Jason has tears looking at his grandmother's house. And eggs.
And eggs. I think some really touching, very strong men showing their hearts. I'm so impressed. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
So speaking of that, we then have, you know, Tara, Jason, and Andy are set up for next season.
Ugh.
You know, I mean, this is a devastating loss.
It's
and I think,
so
you know,
heartbreaking
to have, it's you know, again, to have Rutina play it so truthfully as well.
Yes. I mean, the writing is so cruel because they had gotten out. They had survived.
I know.
Right? They were out. They were in love.
And then, of course, we'll have to deal with, you know, Jason and Andy spend the whole episode talking about what heroes they are. And of course, they end it the farthest thing from a hero as possible. So it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see how everyone reckons with the consequences of this next season.
Yes, very much.
And then we have Eric and Pam. Mm-hmm. You guys, you're in some trouble. With the queen.
I hit my makers. I'm not in any trouble. What are you looking at me for? I didn't do anything.
I'm pretty sure the same, you know, whatever rains down on Eric.
That's true.
Rains down on Pam.
Yeah, she's happy.
And of course, Lafayette is mixed up with all you guys as well now.
Oh, I know. There's some good dialogue for Pam coming up with Lafayette and Is that season three? I think it is.
I think it must be. And then, yeah, you know, finally, Jess and Hoyt, we have this sort of missed connection between them.
Yeah, another heartbreaker.
Another heartbreaker. I think
that,
you know,
moment.
Hoyt sort of finally realizes that he's, you know, picked the wrong woman in that fight.
He bet on the wrong horse.
And shows up. But Jessica, I think, you know, has already kind of decided she's not good enough for him. Right. And has decided to move on and just try to be this new person, this new vampire that she is. So they flew me to Louisiana to just shoot that one scene.
You're
in that
kidding.
Truck. Yep. I mean, we could have shot that on any any intersection anywhere in the world.
Oh my gosh, but it was cheaper to fly you.
They took me and John Hillard, who plays Hank the trucker. They flew us to Louisiana to shoot in that truck. It was sweltering.
Oh my, you actually felt you were hot instead of being too cold.
Oh my God. Finally, we were too hot. But the problem is vampires are not meant to sweat. So they removed the sweat. I mean, they were jumping in between every single take and mopping my brow. But they also had to digitally remove my beads of sweat in post.
I think that's worse to be too hot than too cold, although I complained a lot about the cold. But that's worse, isn't it?
You get a little sloppy, you know, a little sort of slow.
Right,
which is funny.
Right.
And of course, I'm straddling him.
Right.
In this tiny cab, and they're getting lights in there, and you're trying to get a camera. And oh my God, it was quite a tight squeeze.
Horrendous.
So yeah, so we had John Hillard, who was a fantastic actor to sort of jump into this with immediately.
So
he
good.
Had the idea of reaching for the condom, which I think is spectacular.
Oh, that's
and you'll
brilliant.
Notice because it motivates my line in such a great
way. Yeah.
And you'll notice that when I bite him, he drops it on his shoulder. So you sort of see it. It's pretty spectacular. So as you rewatch that scene, you'll notice that little moment.
Oh, I'm going to watch it again. That's so funny.
It's so funny. And then one other thing, if you didn't know, Alan Ball wrote minisodes, tiny little snippets that came out between the second and third seasons.
Oh.
And one of those minisodes focus on Jessica as she shows up at this casino looking for dinner. And she has kind of a run-in with an interesting older man. And then at the very end of that, Hank the trucker walks in and we sort of see how that connection was made.
My gosh.
So I really recommend it. Go online, look for the True Blood mini-sodes, specifically the Jessica one. And now for a quick bite. Jason Stackhouse and the Art of the Malibu.
A malaprop is the unintentional misuse of a word or phrase, which then alters its meaning in a humorous way.
Famous examples include, I might just fade into Bolivian, or what do I look like, an inferior decorator, or the 16th chapel.
The fun of the malaprop is in the earnest intention of the speaker. Mm. They think they know what they are saying, and we understand what they mean to say, but it all just comes out a little funny.
Now, Jason Stackhouse is a true master of the malaprop, and so without further ado, we'll let him give you the perpendiculars.
Evil is making the premeditated choice to be a dick. If we're gonna get out of here, we're gonna need even a bigger divergence. Hasta la vista, baby. Love the smell of nail polish in the morning. It's like if a tree falls in the woods, it's still a tree, ain't it?
For the deep dive this week, you did a lot of wonderful research into the mythology behind the main event of this episode.
I will reveal, I think I spent 10 hours yesterday putting this outline together.
Oh, I can see this.
No one in the world other than me and the True Blood writers and my mother is this interested in Dionysus and Maenads, but
and your brother, who is our sound engineer. And right before we started recording, he said, "Ooh, I'm really looking forward to this."
to my Greek history lesson. Are you ready, people at home?
Yes. Mainly what I got out of it, reading it, is these Greek gods are
absolute dicks. The moral of the story here is that, you know, Zeus is an adulterous asshole and Hera is a vengeful witch. Basically, if Zeus just kept it in his pants and Hera like divorced him, everything would have been fine. We'd have had no Greek drama.
Right. We'd nothing. And we'd have no season two for True Blood.
There'd be no great Greek, you know, Greek plays to be done anymore.
No,
because all of the gods would have behaved themselves.
I just pictured them living today. Yes. They would have an amazing reality TV show. Oh my God.
They would be a hit. They'd have millions of followers on Instagram. I mean, these people are absolutely chaotic evil. So yes, we'll start with Dionysus. So Dionysus, like any, you know, Greek god, has many origins. So it starts when Zeus impregnates Persephone. So she gives birth to this horned infant god. But Zeus's wife, Hera, in a jealous rage, sends the Titans to literally dismember the baby limb from limb. Right? But each piece of Dionysus then transforms into a new form, which attacks them back. The final form is this huge bull, just like we saw on the show. So, you know, that kind of plays into all of this. But eventually the Titans get the job done and are able to destroy Dionysus before he's, you know, a month old. He's ripped apart by the Titans. So
again,
Zeus comes in and imprisons the Titans for murder, right? Even though it's his wife who did it, it was his fault in the beginning. I mean, it's all this, but he imprisons them. Which then angers their mother, Gaia, who is Mother Earth. So she in turn creates floods and fires and boiling seas, causing devastation, war, and just general awfulness for all of us, the Earthlings.
That's not who I think of as
Gaia. Well, Zeus put her kids in prison for, you know, killing his kid. You know, it's all, you know, it's all very deep stuff.
It's a mess. It's a mess.
So Zeus goes back to Earth. He collects the remains of Dionysus's heart. He then mixes it into a drink of blood, which he then gives to Semele, who is the mortal daughter of the king of Thebes. As she drinks this blood that has the remnants of Dionysus's heart in it, it impregnates her with Dionysus. And Zeus tells her that she will be the mother of a son who is the god of revelry, who will finally bring joy and light back to the world. And she's so overjoyed that her son will end this horrible time on Earth that she starts covering herself in vines and flowers and is like celebrating under the full moon. She's so excited about it. So again, we're seeing a lot of this imagery and so forth coming forward in the myths and into True Blood. But here comes Hera again, who really just needs to divorce this Zeus guy. He's just kind of the worst. But again, she punishes the wrong person. And she manipulates Semele into touching Zeus, which burns her to a crisp instantly. But Zeus pulls the baby from her womb in time and gives him to Nisus, who is a lesser god of wine and debauchery, to be raised in the spirit of fun, hence Dionysus. So that's where we get this god from. Pretty intense.
I kept waiting for the Kardashians to be part of this story.
They're like, in there somewhere.
Wouldn't that fit right in?
They're descended from or something like that.
Yeah, there's somewhere in there from what I can tell. So wait, where have we ended up now? So Dionysus was pulled from
literally,
the womb.
He's just born now. This is as far as we've gotten.
Oh, so he's born.
Now been he's born twice. He was born once, destroyed, and then reborn again, and then raised by the a god of wine and debauchery. You know, like you would want to send your toddler to be raised by someone who's drunk and crazy.
A perfect tutor.
He grows up. He is often arrives like his stories are often like him arriving as a foreigner into a new land, you know. So he becomes known as the god who comes, you know, which I guess is quite literal.
Because he shows up.
So he's the god who comes.
Okay. He's the god who shows up.
And whenever the authority, the kind of general theme of this is whenever the authority in town then refuse to recognize his divinity, he punishes them by entrancing their women and chasing the men into the woods. So the women who are then known as maenads. Now, these are either voluntary or involuntary followers, female followers of Dionysus. So maenad literally translates to raging ones, mad ones, raving ones, these kinds of things.
Okay.
So we're seeing a lot of this. They, you know, within True Blood, we're pulling directly from this mythology. They go in the woods. They perform these wild orgiastic rites. They're wearing fawn or fox pelts, which I thought was very interesting concerning Daphne as a deer. There's a lot of fawn and deer metaphors within Dionysus and maenad. So that was, I think, a really interesting thing. And they wear bull helmets, which is, you know, has to do with that final form he took.
Okay.
So they're attempting to reach this level of ecstatic frenzy where they can be possessed by Dionysus and experience freedom from their earthly bodies. So we have an incredible speech from Marianne in an earlier episode where she talks about that, right? Where like the joy of losing yourself, you know, and we think about this with addiction, but also with meditation, but also with, you know, there are so many different ways that people are trying to reach this like state of freedom, of Zen, of Nirvana.
From the physical. Right? Yes. Yes.
So while they're in this state, maenads often are given extraordinary strength and are sort of magically able to create milk, honey, and sustenance from sort of the trees in nature. But they are also drawn to kill animals with their bare hands and eat their hearts raw. So anyone who does not believe in Dionysus or doesn't acknowledge his divinity, he has the men chased into the woods where their own women in their Dionysian frenzy rip them apart and eat them raw, which is, again, this terrifying but fantastic correlation to his first murder as an infant, right? The Titans tore him apart.
Right.
So he's sort of reenacting this trauma over and over again.
Revenge.
You know, again, which is a fantastic metaphor for what humans do, which is this passed on trauma through generations and you know, the way that that works for us. So I mean, this history, I mean, mythology really just fascinates me. It's so violent and almost nonsensical, but there's something fascinating about it.
Well, it's extra fascinating for me when it's after the fact sort of laid over what we see with True Blood, right? So they did such a great job of weaving this in. I would not have known that unless I was doing a podcast with a wool, because it is so, it really is interesting and well thought out, because it goes back to the Queen's speech.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Where she explains, you know, in a, we talked about her incredible performance with all of that information. And they really wove it throughout the entire season.
Well, what they've done that's so brilliant, I think, is, you know, everything we've talked about so far is the mythology. This is all oral tradition stories that were told, probably parables in a sense. But maenads and the tradition of orgiastic rites were real in Greece and Rome. Now, originally they were held in secret and were only for women, which I think is fascinating and amazing.
So interesting.
Because as they grew in number and frequency, you know, men began participating. But at that point, the Roman state actually gets worried about it because they're starting to think, oh, no, these are people gathering and they're planning an insurgence or something like that. So they ban Bacchanalian Dionysian celebrations unless you specifically apply for them. And I feel like nothing kills your orgy like having to get governmental permission. So
Yes, I'm here for a permit
for my orgy.
For what? Well, for an orgy. For an orgy? Yes.
Yes, I am. Yes. I am a follower of Dionysus. I'm really hoping that he'll come. He has an RSVP.
A following of who? I'm picturing like the DMV of ancient Rome with whatever their horrible fluorescent lighting would be the equivalent of. I mean, you'd just be like, sorry, forget the whole idea.
I'm not in the mood anymore.
I'm going to go home and watch HBO now, right? Which I guess that would be you'd go home and watch a book.
You'd watch a book. You'd read a book. You'd read about the mythology of Dionysus and get inspired now to
and then
go
get all excited
secret.
Again and go, yeah, you'd be like, I can do it. I can do it. And you'd walk back in that building and go, oh, forget about it.
Well, but I think now you take on the true spirit of it and you're a Marianne, right? You're a Marianne Forrester, and you take it out into the woods,
right?
And you don't tell the government, and it's even more delicious.
And you don't get a permit.
You don't, because you're living on the edge. So yeah, I mean, there are some just incredible, I mean, we have the whole wedding, you know, a Maenad's desire to have this ultimate, you know, union with Dionysus.
Yeah.
But of course, the only way to really be with him is to die. So all of that is really supported in the original mythology. We have this sacrifice, the killing of animals, or in our case, shapeshifters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, the eating of the heart.
The eating of the heart is right in there. And then also this birthing, right? Mm-hmm. We have this ostrich egg, which is actually more of an Egyptian symbol. But, you know, hey, Maenads have been alive forever. She's probably borrowing imagery from everywhere.
Right.
But, you know, this eggs are always about fecundity, fertility, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And we have this rebirth through Semele as well. So, you know, she's trying to kind of birth Dionysus again so that she can marry him and be with him in eternity by dying.
Wow.
That all kind of fits.
I know. That is amazing. Thank you, Deb. I'm so thrilled for you to hear this interview with the wonderful, fantastic, amazing,
exuberant,
layered, masterful Michelle Forbes as Marianne Forrester.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness.
It's so good to see you. Oh,
and I'm not going to start crying.
No, Kristen will start.
I know. Kristen and I are often in contests. We're often in crying contests.
Well, we generally like to start if you have a story around either your audition or your casting. Like, how did you join this company that is True Blood?
Well, that little meeting with Alan Ball, I think there were some dummy sides that he had that they were having us read. And I didn't have any connection to vampires whatsoever. They didn't even show up in my mind at all. So I just sort of went, and I remember Zeljko Ivanek, who ended up doing the show later, he was in the waiting room, and we had done Homicide: Life on the Streets together, and I hadn't seen him for a gazillion years. And I didn't know what these... It was like half a page, I think. And I didn't know what I was doing. So I kind of went in and had a little chat with Alan. And I thought, well, he's a nice guy. I like this guy. Don't know what I'm doing. But could we sort of get on with this? Because I want to catch Zeljko before he leaves.
Priorities.
Priorities. You got to catch up with your mates. And I don't know. Sometimes you can feel like a connection. But I didn't feel a connection because I didn't know what it was. And it certainly hadn't aired yet.
Right.
So I was so surprised when I got the phone call, and Alan said, yeah, you know, do you want to come do this with us? And I thought, I'm not sure what it is, but I have a good feeling about it. So let's do it.
Wonderfully
strategic career thinking.
Well, but I think that is part of what Alan has, though, right? Like, there's something about his presence, his pedigree, all of that that he brings that, you know, we all just kind of go, yes, I trust you.
Let's leave,
you know?
Well, I mean, that whole experience was all about trust. All of it. from day one till the end, trusting our writers, trusting our fellow actors, trusting our costume designer and our production designer to, you know, do most of the work for us. Right? Trust was everything. I'll tell you a story, actually. It was at the end of the first season. And because I'd only done, I think, two or three episodes at the end of the first season, we were setting that story up for the next season. As I said, not a clue. You know, one minute Alan's talking about Dionysus, and I still don't know what a Maenad is. Not really.
Wow.
It's still a little vague. What a Maenad is, because we kind of played around with the idea of the Maenad, you know? So he's talking about Dionysus, and he was like, you know, do you know your Greek mythology? And I was like, well, I mean, tiny bit. I obviously had to go brush up on it. So we talked a little bit about that, but then, you know, you open the script and it's like, I'm busting a young girl out of jail with a pig in my car and I'm dancing to the B-52s. Where does the Greek stuff come into this? I'm a little confused. So anyway, I'm sitting like behind the monitor and Alan's there and he's writing away. And I said to him, is it like this?
Yeah, finale.
And he was like, no, it's not like that. I was like, okay. And I think about it some more. And I was like, is it like, I don't know. And I bring up some weird idea. And he was like, no, it's not like that. And I said, okay. and my little brain is, you know, the grinding is happening. And I guess he could sort of smell smoke. So I remember he put his hand on my arm and he looked me dead in the eyes. And he said, Mishka, we don't know quite yet. But when we do know, we're going to let you know immediately.
Yeah.
And having worked with so many showrunners who use secrecy almost as like a power move.
Yes.
Right. Where you're not let in to like what's going on.
Right.
When he said that to me, I totally believed him. And I remember my whole system calmed down. And I thought, I can trust this man. And then I got to know our writers and I love them so much. And I was like, I can trust them. So it was really, really all about trust. And especially, you know, it was like a never ending episode of Fear Factor. But I do remember that moment with Alan very vividly. And
especially your storyline. Yeah.
Cause it was, I pulled from all sorts of places. Andora from Bewitched.
Yeah.
Do you remember Andora?
Yes. Absolutely. And I can absolutely see it. Yeah.
Right. And that was the relationship with Sam. You know how she was always torturing Durwood? She never got his name right. Darren. It was always Darwin, Dagwood.
Right.
But she was always just poking at him in the most delicious way. And that's so I kind of threw that in for my relationship with Sam.
Well, but how perfect, because, you know, as we've all seen, Marianne is scary and violent and brutal and all those things, but she's also incredibly charming
and
so much
and
fun.
Lovely and she was wise. Right? So smart to draw from a 60s sitcom, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, there were the dresses too. You remember how she'd always show up in those dresses and she just had this sort of air about her, but it was a combination
Martinis at five kind of air. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a combination of that and Lydia Lunch. I don't know if you guys know Lydia Lunch. She was a part of that no wave
Who
movement back in the 80s. And she was very hedonistic. That whole post punk, no music scene. It was just all about hedonism. It was all about pushing no music. Uh-huh. It was like they wanted no melody. They wanted noise. And I thought about Lydia Lunch a lot while I was doing it. So it was a combo of like this post-punk 60s sitcom.
Right. With like the Dalai Lama thrown in there. Because I'm amazed how every piece of advice that she gives is so wise and so accurate and so brilliant and so perceptive. So she was just a lot of everything.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I knew at one point, like, enjoy this because, I mean, I think I've been very fortunate in this industry to play a lot of characters that are so multidimensional, but she was the most fun of all of them.
And oozes across the screen in your performance.
Yeah.
The fun of it.
But I, you know, I can't take credit for it. I mean, I literally felt like I was just being pulled.
I was being
pulled behind this, you know, beautiful car on fire.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we should, you know, we got to talk about the orgies and what those crazy experiences out in the woods in the middle of the night are really like, because I know everyone at home is like, ooh, sexy, fun, cool. And we want to get the actual truth because we know it's not always that.
So you were out there at Greer, probably.
Oh, Greer Ranch. It was usually about 30, 32 yep. degrees.
Yep.
Yeah.
Everybody unclothed.
Oh my God.
I was very lucky because I was clothed. It was a very thin dress uh-huh. usually. Yes. But I didn't have to wear the black eyes, the black contacts.
Right.
And they yeah. were so painful for so many people, especially yeah. when you're doing a night shoot and it's freezing cold.
Yeah.
Those are really hard. Could they see at all really through them?
From what I understand, not very well, but yeah. also yeah. I think by the very nature of them being black, they're very thick. So they're quite uncomfortable.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Somehow I dodged that bullet. I'm not sure how. But the orgies, yeah, they were something else. I've often said that if anybody walked onto that set with any inhibitions, you left with none.
I saw in an interview that you felt like America was a bit puritanical and, you know, we could maybe lighten up on that a little bit. So the craziness of True Blood, now how you explain it, you were, you know, being pulled behind this car on fire. And also your general outlook is kind of like so artistic. I mean, it's got to be crazy, right? A whole bunch of naked extras having sex with black eyes and, you know, below freezing at Greer Ranch. But still, you went with the whole thing.
What choice did I have? I mean, that was...
That's it,
I
right?
think if I'd had time to think about it, I probably yeah. would not have. You know, when I yeah. do a heavy... dramatic piece, it's so internal that I don't think about what's happening on the outside and that it's not about me. This idea of having fun and this idea of having no inhibitions whatsoever mm-hmm. was, if I'd thought about it, I probably would have run. And I have no idea why Alan hired me, because all of my work tends to be a bit heavy and authoritarian and stern. And, you know, they like it when I'm mean for some reason. And so that season and a half of True Blood, that fun that I got to have, that shedding of all of those worries was really important for me. And it sounds so silly as an actor, because that's what we do, you know, but I just can't explain how much fun it was and how important it was for me as well. And then, like I said, I didn't have a choice. I just had to look at everybody and go like, okay, I trust you. Let's do this. But you know, it's like, we were so lucky with the people we were working with. Nancy Oliver, our beautiful Nancy Oliver. She was directing an episode. It was in the first season. I was bailing Rutina out of jail, and I was in this hippie blouse, flared jeans, high heels, and I was like, still have no clue, guys. Still have no clue what I'm doing. And we were in this very claustrophobic little jail cell, and I was trying to like hide my anxiety, and I kind of went over and had a chat with Nancy, and I was kind of like, I kind of like admitted I didn't know what I was doing. And she said, why don't you just turn around and just give her a big old smile? I was like, huh? Okay, sure. I'll try that. And that was it, guys.
Wow.
Like that. Yeah. Like as soon as I did that, I felt her. Like I felt her like enter my body that sounds really dramatic. But you guys know as actors, like when you find that little key, you open that little door, you're like, ah, that's it. Okay, got it.
Well, and then you surrender, right?
You surrender.
You just surrender to whatever inspiration comes.
And right? I'm a resistor by nature. And there was no room for resisting in this. So it was kind of the perfect vehicle to kick my backside a little bit. And Greg Feinberg as well. I know our brilliant producer, Greg Feinberg. But I was sitting by a tree. We're filming me just like dancing in the forest. And I was sitting sort of by this tree that we were shooting under. And I was squatting. I was sort of like fiddling with the dirt. And he was like, what if you were digging? Because I had the claws on, you know? Yeah. And because we had often talked about this feral aspect of her. And he was like, what if you're digging? I was like, to the center of the earth? He was like, yeah. And I was like, let's do it. Let's do it. And so it was that. It was Greg Feinberg and Nancy Oliver and Audrey Fisher putting me in those clothes and Lana doing the makeup and, you know, Suzuki making those sets. And it was, this is why I feel like I just can't take credit. I just surrendered.
Well, surrender is I think a lot of people we talk to about, a lot of actors we talk to from True Blood and people, you know, directors and writers, mm-hmm. you know, because they're in a writer's room having to put themselves out there and possibly fight for storylines that they want and throw out ideas. You know, writers are definitely generally introverts. And I think the general theme really has been trust, freedom, creativity, also fun. And we don't always get that on every set. And you still have to surrender even when it's not safe to do so.
Yeah,
but between action and cut, you have to, because you have to protect your performance. And that's really challenging. And sometimes we're not rewarded. We're not told, you know, you put your guts out there and then after cut, no one says, hey, amazing job.
Yeah.
You know, or your co-stars are not so fabulous, but on True Blood, it was weird. How
it was weird that everything was harmonious. It was, and I think that's why, it was certainly the aberration, and to know that it's possible, you know, that it doesn't always have to be so ugly and what have you. But again, you know, that's Alan, that it all started with Alan. And I remember he did an interview early on and he said, you know, look, I hire the best people and I get out of the way. And, you know, that takes an enormous amount of integrity, lack of ego, and wisdom. It just allowed this freedom for everyone to create and to do the best that they could. And I know that, like, there was also a profound commitment to collaborating with each other. It was unspoken, but it was so present, I feel. And it was literally like watching the energy arteries bounce off of each other. Mm. It was just wonderful.
Yes,
and to know that everybody was at the top of their game and everybody was just, you know, had this freedom that Alan gave us.
Yeah, that's such amazing. A good description.
Well, and speaking of more, you know, more people to praise, Rutina, I mean, Tara is just a spectacular character in her hands. Mm. And I'm just curious about working with her and that relationship. I mean, there is fire between the two of you in those scenes. If you have any stories or memories from
love
with her.
That girl so much.
Oh.
And I loved our time together. There were times, you know, she's such a powerful actor. And I had to start this one scene and I had my arms around her and I could feel her body shaking. And I could feel the heat coming off of her body.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I did feel so protective of her just in general, just in life. And, you know, this was her first job out of Juilliard, for goodness sake. And it was this huge global hit. So this girl was just like thrust into the stratosphere, right? So I felt very protective of her. I just remember holding her before the scene and just feeling the heat and just being mesmerized as I was working with her. We'd go outside of the studio in between setups and she'd sing and she'd dance. I love it. And
that's what she does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we would just sit there
in
and
between
we would just
takes.
Laugh. And, yeah. And I loved being with her. I loved her company. I learned so much from her.
Yeah.
She's very special. She's a special human. She's a special two-legger.
She's a special two-legger.
So did you continue to watch the show after your season was done? Were you
I did.
True Blood? Were you a Truby?
I absolutely did. because I missed you all so much too. And I'm usually, you know, when I leave a show, I mean, you know, you make friends and I enjoy my freedom. I enjoy knowing that I can do something else, you know, next year. So when it was just, you know, a year's contract, I was like, that's fantastic. That's perfect. Mm. And then I was like, no, I don't want this to end. Mm. No. Yeah. The last day. So we got all the stunts and the working with the bull out of the way when I married the bull and I had a romantic scene with the bull.
It's a gorgeous shot.
It's so beautiful.
I mean, it's this full.
Oh, so good. It was so
wide
beautiful.
Shot, you know.
It's so beautiful.
It comes out of the
and
darkness.
You're so beautiful. It's beautiful.
That was, that was an absolute highlight for me working with that massive creature. Massive creature. And
yeah, tell us about the bull and working with that and what that was like.
So they were so wonderful in preparing us for everything. I went to go meet the bull and Greg Feinberg was there and we put the dress on so that he could be familiar with everything.
Okay.
But they're all very, very, very serious about this. And I didn't quite understand why.
Yes.
And then, so, you know, the date went really well. We got along. We had things in common. And so I showed up.
He's playing
the next
your husband,
day,
right? So,
right? The one that I've been waiting for. And I had all that. I still haven't forgiven Alex Wu, who wrote that episode, and all that purple prose that he wrote for me. My Lord, my Savior. Where have you been? I've waited for you my entire life, my Lord. And I was just like, Alex, what the fuck have you done? And like, I don't know. And I remember in the table read, for some reason, they always sat me next to Scarzi. And Alex was like, I got to it. And I couldn't even say it. And I just looked at him like, you fucker. Like, I cannot pull this off. And I remember Skarsgård leaned over and he was like, commit. And I was like, I always commit.
Skarsgård really never committed at a table. But he was probably fucking with you, right?
Totally. Oh, totally fucking with
you. Yeah.
And I loved
it. So funny.
The next day I go in, the next night and we're having the scene with the bull and I'm in the makeup trailer and I'm not really thinking about it. And all these guys sort of come in and they're sort of staring at their feet. And I'm like, and it's getting weird. And I'm like, what's up, guys? And they were like, well, you know that bull you met yesterday? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, well, special effects guys, you know, they had to make a bull head.
Right.
That matched his for when I got gored to do the special effects. So these lovely special effects guys made the wise decision to take this bull head to the bull, see how the bull would react. And the bull lost its mind. And so they're telling me the story and I'm like, I don't know where they're going with it. And I was like, so what happens now? And they were like, well, that bull won't be here today because he was too violent to load into the truck.
Oh.
After being traumatized by seeing this fake bull head. So they brought another bull in. So but we don't know about this bull. And I was like,
this is a blind date.
Well, I'm fine. Like I don't feel weird about it. I went to set. Right. Like I thought Greg was about to have a stroke.
Right.
And I said to Greg, I was like, Greg, I'm fine, dude. Like, don't worry about it. Like, I'm not worried.
Okay.
I didn't quite know what was going to go on in this scene. So, and once I was standing in front of this new bull and you see the horns and you think like, oh, I get it. If he spooks, like he moves his head.
Right.
I'm like, my skull is crushed and I'm on the ground. Like, I get it.
Right. Yeah. And there's cameras. So, like, that's the thing. It's not like
lights,
we're watching
cameras,
it on screen going,
yeah.
It's just a woman with an animal. But there's like 50 people that the bull's looking at and camera equipment and booms and lights. And
well, not only that, they put like a chain around two of his legs and then they had two guys on horses.
Oh my God.
So that if they could mobilize him somehow. So they were in the scene as I have all of this really challenging dialogue
oh
to
my gosh.
Make work. they are in the scene, right, in the shot, and they're CGI'd out. So there are two guys on horseback with me in the bowl.
Oh my gosh.
And wow. And they're going, yeah, yeah. And I'm going, oh my Lord, oh my. So it was challenging for sure. And I loved every fucking minute of it.
It is a stunning shot. A stunning performance.
They did do such an amazing job with camera, and the photography was beautiful. Yeah. Was beautiful, yeah, during that whole passage.
It was beautiful. And you did an amazing job at saying that dialogue that is tricky dialogue. And you are emotional and grounded and underplayed, and like it's perfect. We really believe.
Oh, you're so sweet, Kristen.
Yeah, because it's a tough thing to be like my Lord to a bull, right? Like, but my boyfriend. and somehow I'm like, wow, I'm totally buying this.
But that's that crazy thing as actors that we just, you know, we want to do the job. We want to do a good job.
Yeah.
And then there's a part of me also that goes, what other time in my life could I step into a pen with a rhino, act opposite a bull, or work with wolf hybrids? You know, like at a certain point you go, this is not only a hard part of the job, but frankly, one of the weird perks, have these experiences.
It's such a wonderful perk of what we do. All the different things, all the different things we get to explore, all the strange situations. This is what I love so much about what we do. It's like I said, the never-ending question mark. You never know what's on the docket for tomorrow.
Well, we have some questions. When you think of your experience on True Blood, are there three words that come to mind?
Oh, heavens. Freedom, collaboration, and joy.
Joy.
Now, that word doesn't come out of my mouth too often. So
I know. That's why I'm crying again. Like, joy? Yeah. Are you kidding me? Like, joy. Elusive joy?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I think back to that time, that's what I feel like. My heart kind of opens up a little bit if I think about it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle, for coming on. Yeah. Mishka, for coming on and talking with us and sharing all these stories. It has just been a pleasure watching your work on True Blood and everywhere else.
I just love you both so much. And I love that we have all shared this time together. So back then and now. Yeah. And we'll continue to. Friends forever.
We're family.
Trubies forever.
Family. It is always the greatest time talking with Mishka. She's such a talented person and just so funny and personable.
Yeah. Ugh. I know. And the way she puts things, I was taking notes like I was listening to a guru. I don't know. I just like the way she phrases things, and it's fascinating.
It is.
And oh, God. She's so unique and thoughtful and funny and kind and talented. It's
there's
crazy.
Something so wonderful too to hear her talk about her doubts or having to surrender and feeling like she didn't know what she was doing. And then to have watched it and seen just how she leaps off that screen. Because as a performer, so much of the time we go home and go, oh, I was terrible, or it didn't, you know, you have these weird feelings. And to see that, like, sometimes that is a little bit of a disconnect, right? Like that her performance stands out as like one of the best of the show.
Yeah. Specifically that scene where she's talking about where she turned and smiled, that Nancy gave her that in the jail. And I remember thinking in that scene, oh my God, she's just absolutely glowing and living in this character. And that wasn't her inner world.
And what an incredible choice. And she didn't feel brave doing it, that's what comes for me. And I think it is. It's that surrender. Yeah. It's that ability to just trust the story, trust yourself, and trust the others.
She's incredible.
Next season on True Blood, our universe expands even more as we are introduced to wares, including a rather fetching werewolf named Alcide.
Yep.
We're going to learn more about vampire royalty and meet the absolutely riveting Russell Edgerton. Jason gets involved with a were community of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Sookie investigates her fantastical heritage. And Bill has to deal with the fallout from his past mistakes.
Meanwhile, Sam tangles with his shapeshifter roots, while Tara and Lafayette deal with both their inner demons and those more corporeal with the help of the bewitching Jesus. Mm. Ugh. There is so much more we have to share with you, and so many more of our cast and crew to introduce to you.
Yes. So first of all, thank you so much for supporting this little podcast that could. It has been an enormous privilege to bring you this content, and we'd love nothing more than to just see it through to the end.
Yes. So if you want to hear more, please help us get a third season by rating and reviewing the podcast.
5 stars.
Yeah, we want 5 stars. Shout out about us on social media and let HBO know how much you like what we're doing.
And with that, thank you for another fantastic season, Troopies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we hope to see you next season.
Y'all come back now. You're here.
Got any burning questions you want answered on Truest Blood? Post them on any and all social media platforms using hashtag FangClubQuestions, and we may feature them on the show. That's hashtag FangClubQuestions. Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO Max. Executive producers are Janina Gavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galon, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on HBO Max.